Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid argues that the United States should talk to the Taliban. With delays in talks, he writes, the risks of a wider conflict will grow, an opening that al-Qaeda and other extremist groups will press. Ahmed Rashid has been covering the Taliban longer than just about any other journalist. He had a book published in 2000 entitled Taliban, Militant Islam, Oil, and Fundamentalism in Central Asia that's become a must-read for military analysts, government officials, and students. A second updated edition of the book has just been released. Ahmed Rashid joins me in the studio. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you very much. Great pleasure.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. Our toll-free number is 1-800-433-8850, or you can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Well, we have just, in the past few days, had the Nuclear Security Summit here in Washington, D.C., which put a certain spotlight on Pakistan. What did the Pakistani Prime Minister say at this session?
Well, of course, I mean, it was very important that Pakistan make a very strong statement about securing its nuclear materials and nuclear weapons because, you know, Pakistan has been guilty of proliferation in the past, helping North Korea, helping Iran. And the Pakistanis were very tough about that, saying they're absolutely secure. And President Obama, in fact, gave a statement saying he believed that the Pakistani nuclear materials were safe.
Do you believe that yourself?
Yes, I think so. But I think the real problem that now Pakistan will have with the international community is that there's, you know, part of this conference was to stop the production of fissile material, of the fuel to make nuclear bombs. And Pakistan says that it won't stop it because India still has more bombs than Pakistan. Pakistan needs to catch up and make more bombs. So there's still a kind of arms race between India and Pakistan, nuclear arms race, which is terribly dangerous, obviously, and puts, you know, both, especially both India and Pakistan, outside this present agreement that took place.
In just a few weeks, we'll see Afghanistan's President Karzai visit in Washington. What is the agenda for that meeting?
Well, I think it's a terribly important meeting because, first of all, you know, there's been this terrible spat between the Americans and Karzai, a lot of back and forth that has endangered the relationship. I think that's over now, and Karzai has accepted whatever apologies President Obama and others in the administration have given him. And he's also, I think, kind of apologized. But I think, you know, the real agenda is that, you know, Karzai, I think, wants two or three questions answered. He wants to know what is U.S. strategy in the build-up to what President Obama had said was this date of July 2011 when the U.S. will start withdrawing and presumably NATO troops will start withdrawing. What is the U.S. strategy up to then and after that? Secondly, I think he very much wants U.S. support for what is called reconciliation, and that means talking to the Taliban leadership. Now, the U.S. is backing already the idea of reintegration, which means talking to and winning over the rank and file, the foot soldiers, but it is not supporting the idea of yet talking to the Taliban leaders. And U.S. commanders like General McChrystal and General Petraeus have said that, you know, we need to beat back the Taliban. We need to reduce their military might over the next 6 months before we actually talk to them. Karzai wants it to happen now.
You have written that it's important for the United States to talk to the Taliban. Why do you think that's important?
Well, I fear very much that if the U.S. delays this indefinitely and doesn't put out a proper strategy for the next year to 18 months, what we are seeing in the region are two things. The first is that the region, and by that I mean Pakistan, Iran, the Central Asian states, India, all the neighboring countries of Afghanistan, they have assumed already that the U.S. is leaving. Now, it's probably wrong because the U.S. has clearly said that, you know, they're not pulling out on one day or anything like that. They'll probably be around for many years to come. But the region, because it assumes that the U.S. is leaving, has started their own lobbying inside Afghanistan with various proxies. And there's terrible competition going on now to exercise influence in what is being termed as the post-U.S. Afghanistan. Now, of course, the worst proxy war that's going on is between India and Pakistan. Pakistan believes it has the edge over everyone because a lot of the Afghan Taliban are living in Pakistan. And Pakistan has told Karzai very bluntly that if you want to talk to the Taliban, you have to come through us. And if you remember, Pakistan made these arrests of some of these Taliban leaders back in February who had actually been talking to Karzai outside Pakistan. So Pakistan wants to be a major player in any kind of post-American Afghanistan. India wants to be a major player, wants to block Pakistan. So does Iran. So I fear this competition would be a repeat of what happened in the 1990s and would be very dangerous.
You say the United States has not yet adopted this policy of talking to the Taliban. Do you see signs that a change is in the works?
I think there's going to be very intense discussion at the highest level of government here in Washington over the next 2 to 3 weeks about this issue. I think what it was has been very markedly missing about the high-level discussion that has taken place, you know, within the cabinet led by the president, has been that this issue actually was not discussed back in December before Obama made his West Point speech. It has not been discussed subsequently, even though Karzai has been urging the Americans to come to a decision. But I think now with the Karzai visit acting as a kind of catalyst, I think there's going to be very serious discussion about this.
Is there a division within the Obama administration's ranks about whether this is a wise thing to do?
I think rather than a division, I would say that people have not been thinking about this seriously enough. I think the White House itself is probably a bit nervous about how they would sell this domestically. You know, how would this go down with the left wing of the Democrat Party? How would this go down with the Republicans who are gunning for Obama? How do they play this? You know, I think that's important. What message do they put out to the region, you know, to the neighboring countries of Afghanistan? I think the U.S. military is very supportive of this. The U.S. military has been in the lead saying to Obama, listen, we should be able to talk and fight at the same time. Just because we are doing the surge and we are fighting and we are trying to beat back the Taliban doesn't mean that we shouldn't be talking at the same time. And I think, you know, now the State Department is coming around. So I think the various elements of the U.S. government are coming around to this, that they have to start somewhere.
If you started negotiations with the Taliban, how would you do it? Would you go through Afghanistan or Pakistan? How would it work?
Well, let me tell you, what I've been suggesting is that first of all, I mean, you need a decision. Once the decision is made, the U.S. is very clear. The negotiations have to be led by President Karzai. But I don't think Karzai is in a position to, you know, he needs U.S. help to structure this negotiation. You need a proper team first, a negotiating team. So far, Karzai has been using his family, his brothers. You know, you can't negotiate something as big as this. You need a representative team, which has to include all the ethnic groups of Afghanistan. I very strongly believe a woman should be on the team so that the Taliban can sort of be face to face with a woman and see the progress women have made so that, you know, so of course the woman issue is very sensitive to somebody like Hillary Clinton, who constantly has been asking, well, what about the women of Afghanistan? How would they react if there was a deal with the Taliban?
Yes, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So I think what the U.S. would be initially would be in the background. It would agree to support reconciliation. It would and it would help Karzai structure this properly. So this happened properly. Eventually, I think the U.S. would have to have face-to-face talks with the Taliban because the Taliban do want to talk to the Americans. Every message that the Taliban has sent via various interlocutors has been, we want to talk to the Americans.
And if you talk to the Taliban, what might you be able to negotiate?
Well, again, I mean, I think, you know, there would be two or three strands of the dialogue. The first would be, obviously, what kind of political settlement could be reached with Karzai? You know, are we talking about a coalition government? Are we talking about power sharing in some form? Would there be the need for a new election or a loya jirga, you know, the traditional tribal assembly? So there would be a very sort of a profound, presumably a political dialogue as to how this settlement would be reached. Secondly, I presume that there would be a questioning about the a social development program, issues like women, Islamic law, all these kinds of things. think the Constitution. And I would obviously be, this could be a real Pandora's box. If this was open, if you start talking about the Constitution and the Taliban start pushing for changes in, for example, women's education, I think this could dynamite the whole thing. So I would really like to see both the Taliban and Karzai's people to basically say, look, we put a blanket over this. And whatever, you know, we should both accept that whatever's happened since 2001 is acceptable to the Afghan nation, and that of course includes education, health, all the progress that has been made, should not be reopened. And I think it's possible that you could persuade the Taliban about this, because the Taliban actually so far in all their messages to the Afghans and to the Americans have never questioned these social issues like women and education and all the rest of it.
But there is a sense that as the United States has changed its goals in Afghanistan and made adopted much more limited goals than President Bush had outlined a couple years ago, that that's included paying less attention to issues like the treatment of women.
Well, you know, I don't think so, because, I mean, this civilian surge that, you know, the military and civilian surge that Obama's doing right now, there's much more money for social development and for the and less wastage of money that happened under Bush. The civilian experts are going out to affect, you know, things like the economy, agriculture, etc. So I'm very hopeful that actually, I mean, you know, there's going to be much quicker progress in the next year than what we've seen in the past.
We're talking to Ahmed Rashid about the reissue of his book, The Taliban, and about developments in Afghanistan and Pakistan and involving the Taliban. Our phone lines are open. You can call us at 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email. You can find us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio is Ahmed Rashid. He's the author of the book called Taliban, Militant Islam, Oil, and Fundamentalism in Central Asia. It's become a must-read for many analysts since it was first published in 2000. You know, we've just seen a news report come across the wire from Kandahar, Afghanistan, reporting that a car bomb exploded outside a hotel in Kandahar on Thursday afternoon, injuring at least six people while fighting in the north of the country left four German troops dead. Ahmed Rashid, what do you make of this?
Well, you know, Kandahar, of course, is the next target for General McChrystal and the surge. There are plans to have a major offensive to clear the Taliban from the city and from the district surrounding Kandahar and to stabilize Kandahar and to bring in more development. And obviously, this car bomb that we've just heard about in this hotel in Kandahar is a reaction of the Taliban and proving and demonstrating that the Taliban are actually inside the city and can launch attacks from within the city. As far as the German thing is concerned, well, you know, this will be extremely sensitive back in Germany, because 80% of the German population have said that they want their troops. They've got about 4,500 troops in northern Afghanistan. They want their troops withdrawn. And Angela Merkel, the Chancellor, is under enormous pressure from the opposition parties, from parliament, and from her public to withdraw German troops quickly.
What kind of staying power do you think the West is going to have in Afghanistan, which has been a long war, a long fight, Do you think that NATO and US troops are going to be there for years and years to come?
Well, exactly. I mean, this war has gone on for 9 years. It's the longest war in the 20th or 21st century. Longer than the Second World War, the First World War, than any other war. And I think that with this, unfortunately, this date that Obama set, July 2011, I think this date will also mean that a lot of NATO countries who've got strong public opposition to their involvement in Afghanistan are going to use this date as a way to get out and move their troops out. And even though I think American troops will not be moving out in large numbers so quickly, I think we may well see a withdrawal from NATO troops. You know, some troops, I mean, the Canadians have already said they're going to move out because their time is up. They'd said many years ago that they would move out in 2011. The Dutch government a couple of months ago fell. I mean, it collapsed because it couldn't get the votes in parliament for a continuation of troop deployment. So there's a huge movement in Europe in many of these countries for troops to move out. In Britain, an election is coming up right now, a very critical election, and this troop issue is very important. I mean, Britain has something like 10,000 troops in Afghanistan.
We have reports in several newspapers this morning, including the front page of the New York Times, about the last American soldier leaving an outpost in Afghanistan, which has become to be known as the Valley of Death. Tell us about this place.
Well, you know, this is in the far northeast of Afghanistan. It's in a very, very rugged terrain. These people have historically, the people who live there have historically been very isolated from the mainstream Afghanistan for many, many years. This is an area which the Soviets even tried to occupy, but then gave up and basically withdrew. And U.S. forces went in there basically to try and prevent the Taliban and their allies from using this valley, the Korangal Valley, to be able to muster forces and supplies and then launch attacks in other more urban and settled areas of Afghanistan. And when U.S. troops went in, essentially, Al-Qaeda was very strong there. Another pro-Taliban group, Hizb Islami, was very strong there, very ruthless. And basically, you know, U.S. forces couldn't get to grips because the local villagers were had been enmeshed in several feuds, and they were not willing to support the American forces there. And there were a lot of very tragic accidents, including a recent book that has just come out about this special forces group, four men, three of whom were killed by the local villagers. And then I think 12 or 16 special forces went in to rescue the remaining man, and that whole helicopter went down, these 12 special forces guys died. So there have been terrible casualties there. Up to 40 Americans, I think, have been killed. And really, with McChrystal's new counterterrorism plan, which is all about protecting population centers, this is not. This doesn't fit in because this valley is not heavily populated. It's not a place you can really do development work because they're very scattered villages and few people. So I think it's quite sensible that they pulled out because they can concentrate these forces in more important areas.
42 Americans killed over the years in this valley, as well as many Afghan soldiers. With the benefit of hindsight, was it misguided to go and make a stand there?
Well, I think, you know, perhaps it was, actually, because I think the American forces initially were pushed into going up there by President Karzai because he didn't want to admit that this valley had, the entire valley was in the control of the Taliban. And the very fact that there was that U.S. forces would go up and set a base there, even though for much of the time they never went out of the base. They couldn't go out because they were surrounded by the Taliban and by Al-Qaeda. The fact that there was a U.S. presence there meant that he could say, well, the valley is not in the control of the Taliban.
Let's go to the phones and let some of our listeners join our conversation. We'll go first to John in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. John, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Great show. Love it. The question I have is the following. You talk about the U.S. sitting down and negotiating with the Taliban. Now, again, could be, you know, my ignorance. But from what I've been reading, you know, the Taliban seem to be a gang of thugs or, you know, what have you. And again, this is based on, you know, maybe my false readings of, you know, their description. Does the Taliban have a political arm, an intellectual arm that the U.S. can sit down and talk to? You know, from everything we've heard or read or seen, you know, they just fight. You know, they don't, you know, they don't talk much. They abuse their women. And, you know, is there a wing that can sit down and negotiate and come to an agreement once we sit down and negotiate with them to stop the fighting?
All right, John, thanks for your call.
Yes, there is, certainly. I mean, you know, even before 9/11, I mean, we saw, even though Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban, was supporting the presence of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, there were many Taliban in what is called the leadership shura or council who wanted to negotiate with the Americans and prevent the invasion back in 2001. Now, certainly, you know, the number two of the Taliban who was arrested in Pakistan back in February, Mullah Brader, he's someone who's been known to be negotiating, or his representatives have been negotiating with Karzai, with the United Nations, for quite some time. So, you know, and I think there are several reasons why the Taliban are possibly open to negotiations. I think they're very tired, they're very exhausted, they've suffered enormous casualties. I think they also see an end game coming, and they see that, you know, they have two choices. Either they sit out the American withdrawal and then they go for, you know, grabbing Kabul and grabbing all power, or they negotiate some kind of deal beforehand. And what they, I think, realize now is that if they grab power or try and grab power 2 or 3 years down the road, they will once again be the pariahs that they were before in the 90s. They will be isolated and alienated. And they don't want that to happen again because, you know, they won't be able to do anything for the Afghan people. They will lose their influence and power. It's better that they do a deal now with a leader like Karzai who's at least acknowledged by the West.
And is that the view, do you think, of most Taliban leaders or of it just a faction of the Taliban? And also, how united are the, how monolithic do you think the Taliban leadership is when it comes to questions like negotiation?
Well, there are several Taliban groups, but the main Taliban, that is the Taliban that was ousted from power in 2001 and remains led by Mullah Omar, is what we're talking about. I mean, they're the Taliban who, in a sense, claim legitimacy from the fact that they're waging this war against foreign occupation and the Americans and all the rest of it. Now, there are several very ruthless figures who are allied to the Taliban and have separate groups. One is Jalaluddin Haqqani, and the other is Gulbuddin Hikmatyar of Hizb-e-Islami, who, in fact, was the guy who has been largely responsible for killing American troops in this valley we spoke about earlier. Bringing these allies on board would be clearly much more difficult. But the real, if you like, the legitimacy of the resistance comes from Mullah Omar and Mullah Brader and this Taliban council. And I think, I don't know, but I think a lot of the council is now in favor of some kind of negotiated settlement. And from the U.S. front, don't forget, I mean, both General Petraeus and General McChrystal have told the U.S. public and the U.S. government that we, the U.S. military, cannot win this war. We will have to, at the end of the day, have a political settlement. So, you know, from both sides, you're seeing that this is not a war that can be won on the ground by military force alone.
We often see things happening in private that we don't know about before they happen in public. Do you think there are already behind the scenes negotiations or talks between U.S. officials and the Taliban?
No, I don't think so. I think this has been a very politically sensitive issue, and until it's decided by the president himself to go ahead with something like that, I don't think there would be. What, of course, has been happening is that the U.S. officials have been monitoring other people who have been talking to the Taliban, and they've been very closely in touch with them. People from the Karzai government, people from the United Nations and other countries who have been indirectly talking to the Taliban. But I don't think, you know, I mean, this is a political decision that has to be taken by the president before you get people like the CIA or the State Department getting involved in talking to the Taliban.
Does the Obama administration, officials in the Obama administration, do they reach out and talk to you about your view about what is going on there?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, certainly. I mean, you know, they ask me a lot of questions. I ask them a lot of questions. You know, they are interested in my views simply because I've had this long-running 30-year relationship with Afghanistan. You know, I know all the players and the leaders and everyone else.
Do you think that the U.S. officials are pretty sophisticated and understand very well what's going on in Afghanistan, or is there some misunderstanding or lack of knowledge about how things are really working?
Well, you know, I think there have been problems here between the White House and the State Department and the Defense Department. There's a full team of something like 40, 50 experts and officials working under Ambassador Richard Holbrooke at the State Department on Afghanistan and Pakistan, what is called the AFPAC team. And these are made up, it's an interagency team. They're academic experts. They are regular State Department guys, and it's very comprehensive. And there's a similar team in the Defense Department, which brings in, you know, all the intelligence people and the people from CENTCOM, the Central Command in the Middle East, and regular Army guys and the Marines and all the rest of it. And they make up something like 50%. I think the weakness so far has been in the White House itself, because what I've realized is that there are very few people in the White House who actually have actual experience of Afghanistan, Pakistan. But I think that is changing. I think we are going to see changes in that. We are going to see more experts come into the White House and the National Security Council so that they can do better liaison with the State Department team and with the Defense Department team.
There was a lot of interest when Ambassador Holbrooke was named to be a special representative in this region, but we haven't heard so much about him recently. What kind of role is he playing?
Well, I think he has played a very important role. I mean, it's a huge agenda. I mean, first of all, you know, you have to maintain a relationship with Karzai, which and the whole Afghan government, the parliament, the opposition leaders. That's something he's been doing. He just he came back from Kabul yesterday after spending several days there with General Petraeus. He also has to try and put together this some kind of regional agreement. In other words, what I was talking about earlier, you know, stop the neighboring countries from fighting over the spoils of Afghanistan. Stop this bloody competition between, you know, India and Pakistan, Iran and Pakistan and other countries in the region that have been happening. And thirdly, I think, you know, this team has been very involved in this development surge. You know, how do the Western forces and allies use aid and in order to really get the economy moving, get agriculture moving, get rid of drugs, and help development, so that, you know, you're not just beating back the Taliban, but you're actually trying to set up an indigenous economy which is self-sustaining and will not be forever dependent on aid.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Let's go back to the phones and talk to David. He's calling us from Jonesboro, Arkansas. David, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. My comment is that, and I speak for a large number of people, I believe, that I don't view the Taliban to be a legitimate political organization. I view them as a terrorist group. I feel like if the Obama administration wants to count coup and gain brownie points by negotiating with people, they should go to legitimate governments such as Cuba and North Korea, and that the idea of negotiations with the Taliban is ludicrous.
Well, David, thanks for your call. You know, you had mentioned the domestic political dimension for the United States of having talks with the Taliban. David's certainly reflecting a point of view that would be very critical of that.
Well, you know, certainly. I mean, it depends. You know, I have no idea how the administration will play this domestically once they, if they do, and once they do accept the fact that talking to the Taliban is necessary. But you know, I think David, the point is that the military's message, the U.S. military is sending a very clear message to the administration and to Congress that the U.S. military cannot continue this war indefinitely. They cannot be fighting the Taliban for the next 5 to 10 years. They need some kind of political settlement. I mean, you know, you've been involved in two wars over the for 10 years now, and the military obviously is overstretched.
Here's a message we got from Joyce in Arizona. She put it on Facebook. She said, in your opinion, Mr. Rashid, what are the desires of the majority of the people in Afghanistan? Do they want a free society or a restrictive one? Are their political leaders representing what a majority of the population wants?
I think the majority of the people want an end to the war. They want an end to this insecurity that they're facing. They want an end to these suicide bombers and, you know, everything else that is making their lives so miserable and is preventing, you know, real economy taking off, jobs and all the rest of it. Now, of course, within that, there are also many views. I mean, there are many people who are very wary, obviously, of talking to the Taliban. The northern groups, that is the non-Pashtuns, the Taliban belong to the Pashtun ethnic group. The non-Pashtuns are very wary of dialogue.
We're going to take another very short break. When we come back, we'll take more of your calls and questions in our conversation with Ahmed Rashid. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working to help families earn it, keep it, save it during Financial Literacy Month. On the web at aecf.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Jeff Goodell, author of How to Cool the Planet.
If we had to cool the planet off in a hurry, if we had to take some kind of action, if we have something like the climate equivalent of the sort of subprime mortgage meltdown, what would we do?
Goodell says ideas like launching particles into the stratosphere to reflect sunlight are now being taken seriously. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio is Ahmed Rashid, a Pakistani journalist and the author of the book called Taliban. Here's an email we've gotten from Sri, who writes, I followed Mr. Rashid for a long time and have known him to be a fairly objective journalist, but I am completely taken aback by his position these days about talking to the Taliban now. How is this different than the philosophy that the USA has followed so far about making a pact with a lesser devil? We did this by cozying up with Saddam to beat the Iranians, cozying up to guess who, the Taliban, to deal with the Soviets. Talking to the Taliban, this person writes, will be a disservice to the soldiers who gave their lives so far. The only way to deal with these people who want to live in the Middle Ages is to send them to the Middle Ages. How would you respond?
Well, you know, I agree with you. I mean, a lot of people have been asking me the very same question. I tell you, I mean, my bottom line is I really fear that what is going to happen is that the U.S. is going to withdraw from Afghanistan. There's no question in my mind. With your recession, with the military pressures, the rotation issue of how, you know, how troops can be rotated, you are going to withdraw sooner rather than later. NATO is going to jump at the chance to get out as fast as possible. Now, if there is no political settlement, we're going to be left with possibly a catastrophic civil war in Afghanistan, and possibly a catastrophic civil war in Pakistan too. Why? Because, you know, the Taliban will attempt to seize power. The Northern Alliance and other groups will absolutely try and prevent that. The danger of an internal civil war is enormous. And don't forget, Pakistan is also suffering from terrible Taliban attacks. And, you know, if the U.S. withdraws without a political settlement and the Taliban, you know, try and take Kabul or whatever, that is going to prompt, that is going to be very inspiring to the Pakistani Taliban, who are going to try and expand their operations. And what I fear is a much wider regional conflict. So what one would like to see is a political deal brokered by the West, which at least could possibly result in some kind of cessation of the war.
You talked about the Pakistani Taliban. What are the differences between the Taliban in Afghanistan and the Taliban in Pakistan?
Well, you know, I mean, they're both pretty awful. There's no question about it. But the Pakistani Taliban are probably more ruthless than the Afghan Taliban, simply because they are more ideological. They've been, you know, the Pakistani Taliban are made up of these Pashtun tribes who've been living close to the border with Afghanistan and have been living for the last 9 years with Al-Qaeda and with the Afghan Taliban. And they have become, as a result of this, very ideological. Many of these young Pakistani fighters have been ideologized at a local level, and also then they've been through these religious schools where they've been taught to sort of hate and now, you know, they see no compunction in killing Pakistani civilians and Pakistani soldiers. So initially they started out as fighting for the Afghan Taliban, killing Americans and Westerners in Afghanistan. Now they're killing Pakistanis, and it's a very dangerous phenomenon. It's becoming a countrywide phenomenon.
Where does the Pakistani government stand when it comes to negotiating with the Taliban? Do they want to see the U.S. go down this path?
Yes, certainly. I mean, you know, but the problem here is that the Pakistani military, which is in control of foreign policy and certainly control of Afghan policy, wants to be the dominant player in this. Because the Pakistani military has for the last 9 years played this double game of both being a U.S. ally, but at the same time hosting the Afghan Taliban leadership, the Pakistani military is simply saying at the moment, well, if Karzai wants to negotiate with the Pakistani Taliban, or if you, America, want to negotiate, you come through Islamabad, come through us. And you know, we want to hold all the cards. Now, I personally think that is very dangerous, because this is something the Afghans are not likely to accept. And, of course, regional countries are not likely to accept. Pakistan has a stake in Afghanistan. It has interests in Afghanistan. But I think if we overreach, if Pakistan overreaches in any way, I think it can be hugely detrimental to the peace process and to the region.
Here's a question that Mark has posted for us on Facebook. Mark writes, is there any way to demilitarize the Taliban? It's a strong and efficient organization. If it could be refocused and de-radicalized, it could be an ally rather than an enemy. Isn't Al-Qaeda the real enemy, after all?
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, I think part of these negotiations, if they are held, will be about, for example, how do you bring the Taliban into the system? I mean, do you allow them to, for example, join the Afghan army? Do you allow them to join the Afghan police? Do you make some of their political leaders, allow them to stand for elections, or make them give them political posts in the government in the provinces? All these things, you know, will have to be discussed. What kind of power sharing will take place? I think it's terribly important that, I think, if the Taliban show a willingness to drop you know, their past record of killing and war, if they are prepared to take part in the rebuilding of Afghanistan, and they accept the basic tenets of the constitution and etc., I think they should be brought into the system. That will be the only way that you can actually end this war. And by the way, this has happened before. I mean, we saw, for example, in the 2004 elections, more than 30 militants from various groups are actually sitting in parliament right now. So this is not an impossible. And you know, these ex-militants who are sitting in parliament have not been creating major problems. You know, they haven't been saying, you know, ban all women from education, or, I mean, what, you know, a quarter of parliament is made up of women. And they've been interacting with these women. So the past record has not been too bad.
Let's go back to the phones. We'll talk to Eric. He's calling us from here in Washington, D.C. Eric, hi. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. I'd like to thank Mr. Rashid for joining us. I have two questions. The first one is, what role are other Muslim countries other than Iran and Pakistan playing in trying to get the Taliban to negotiate with the Afghan government, especially Saudi Arabia? And my other question is has the recent coup in Kyrgyzstan, does that look like it's going to affect U.S. tactics in Afghanistan?
Well, certainly Saudi Arabia has been a venue for talks over the last year, talks between representatives of President Karzai and representatives of the Taliban. And the Saudis have played a very discreet role in allowing both sides to come to Saudi Arabia and hold discussions, etc. So, and of course, Saudi Arabia has huge sort of a prestige and clout because of the fact that, you know, Makkah and Medina, the holy cities for all Muslims, is in Saudi Arabia. And they're able to use that as a kind of a lure for, you know, for these negotiations. I think other, you know, other countries have been, Turkey, for example, has been very close to these negotiations and is very keen to play a moderating role. And I think once you see the Americans accept the idea of negotiations, I think you'll see other Muslim countries, Arab countries, come to the fore in trying to help this process. Because I think all the Muslim world wants an end to this war, and they want to see a negotiated settlement. They want to see the Americans out of Afghanistan, a peaceful Afghanistan, because, of course, all these Muslim countries have been suffering from this kind of Taliban model, which is gaining ground everywhere. And, of course, they've been suffering from Al-Qaeda, who are still very active in Afghanistan and Pakistan. That's why the Saudis are involved. As far as Kyrgyzstan is concerned, I think it's up, you know, this whole military surge, which Obama is trying to do right now, is very heavily dependent on Kyrgyzstan, because almost every American soldier that is going to Afghanistan is either going through Kyrgyzstan or is using the air base in Kyrgyzstan for some way. And it's very important, I think, that the U.S. immediately, there are already U.S. officials there now, but, you know, President Putin has just announced a $50 million loan to Kyrgyzstan to help tide over its immediate economic problems. I think the Americans should immediately pump in aid and money and support to Kyrgyzstan. I think one of the big mistakes made both by the Bush administration and by the Obama administration is that they've handled Central Asia as basically part of the war on terror, part of the, you know, that as long as these countries give us bases, well, that's fine. But I think you need a much more broadly based policy about, you know, aid and development and economic reform and encouraging these regimes, which are very dictatorial and very lacking in reform, to carry out political and economic reform. And by backing that reform by aid, not just to the security sector, but also to, you know, ordinary people, improving ordinary people's lives.
Eric, anything else you wanted to ask or say?
No. Thank you for letting me speak on air.
All right. Thank you, Eric. Let's go to Rich calling us from Boston, Massachusetts. Rich, hi. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi. Good afternoon. I just wanted to take this opportunity to kind of ask the guests. The American people do get a lot of left-wing, right-wing, kind of marginal speech about why exactly we're in Afghanistan. And aside from kind of the nuclear threat, let's say, about nuclear weapons falling into the wrong hands due to, say, a civil war or Pakistan could the journalists provide an objective view? I think most Americans, I know myself, views that region of the world as just being characterized by a very tribal area, very combustible area, somewhat incapable of merging into a single nation or a single government. And with that notion, is it a venture that just seemingly is an endless exhaustion of the Americans' time, money, and lives? And if it would be nice if you could provide some insight onto exactly why we're over there, other than this great threat of nuclear weapons.
All right, Rich, thanks for your call.
Well, you know, I mean, the initial reason for going into Afghanistan was to punish Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, because they were hosting Al-Qaeda, for the 9/11 attacks. And a lot of people, like myself, hoped that there would be a military defeat of the Taliban and a quick rebuilding of Afghanistan, which was quite possible and could be easily done at that point in time. But instead, you know, most of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda leadership escaped to Pakistan, and they were allowed to kind of live and set up shop there once again. And then they came back into Afghanistan in 2003, and we had the continuation of this insurgency, which threatened Afghanistan and which threatened the whole rebuilding process. And, of course, the focus was not on Afghanistan, because the Bush administration went off to Iraq to fight a war there. And Afghanistan dropped, you know, very much below the radar screen. I think it's still terribly important that Afghanistan is given a modicum of rebuilding an economy, a national army, a national police, which the Americans are doing now, so that the state structure and the government can stand up and face any threats. And I think, you know, that's what is now happening. For the first time after 9 years, certainly for the last 18 months or 2 years, there's been a huge concerted effort to build up the Afghan state, and making it strong enough so that once the Americans leave and NATO leaves, the Afghan state can take on any threat. But I think now, as part of this, there's no question that the Taliban have also expanded enormously. They're controlling large areas. They have some popular support, and now in order to carry out state building, you can't do it in the midst of a growing insurgency and a civil war. And you need now some kind of end to this.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls and comments. We've gotten several questions on Facebook about opium production and if it should be allowed in Afghanistan and if the Taliban is involved in opium production. Ahmed Rashid, how would you answer that?
Well, everyone's involved in opium production, unfortunately, or everybody's benefiting from it, let me say. The Taliban are certainly funding their operations through the taxes that they impose on both the farmers and the traffickers who take the opium out of Afghanistan. The warlords in many of the tribal leaders and the warlords are getting a cut from this. The opium is fueling massive corruption inside the government, inside the police and the military, the Afghan military. So it's a big threat. It's an enormous threat. And you're not until you deal with this problem, you're not going to get the Taliban insurgency reduced, because so much of their funding comes from opium. The problem, of course, was that for many years, the U.S. government refused to allow the U.S. military to interdict opium traffickers and supplies. Only in the last 18 months, 2 years or so, is the U.S. military actively involved in stopping raiding opium laboratories and centers and catching traffickers and actually catching caches of opium. Now, I think this has resulted in very positive reduction in partly in opium production, but also in seizures of opium before it's exported out to the West. Now, the other part of the equation, of course, is to get farmers to stop growing poppy, which produces opium. And for the first time, we are seeing much greater development emphasis by the Americans on agriculture. That is providing new seeds, fertilizer, water, roads, farm-to-market roads, all the kind of investment that is needed in the rural areas to get farmers to wean off opium and grow other things.
We're almost out of time, but I want to read this last email from Thomas. He says, I believe if the Taliban really want to talk, they could turn over Osama bin Laden. I'm sure that would cause the U.S. to give them a much better listening ear. Is that a prospect?
I agree with you. I mean, you know, for example, one of the U.S. positions is that, you know, we can't talk to the Taliban until they demonstrate that they've broken their links with Al-Qaeda and bin Laden. Now, you know, the question back is, well, how do the Taliban demonstrate that they've actually broken with Al-Qaeda? I mean, they can say it, but who's going to believe them? Now, one way of demonstrating that you've actually broken with Al-Qaeda is to catch Al-Qaeda or provide the intelligence to the Afghan government or to the Pakistanis or to the U.S. as to where Al-Qaeda is hiding out, because the Taliban leaders certainly know that.
And they certainly do. Do you think there's any real prospect they will do this?
Well, who knows? I mean, you know, the U.S. first has to start a negotiation with the Taliban. Certainly that is going to be the primary demand of the U.S. And the U.S. is going to follow up by saying, well, prove it. Prove that you've broken with Al-Qaeda. And the Taliban will have to come up with something.
Ahmed Rashid, thank you so much for joining us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you very much.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.